Good afternoon and welcome to Unfiltered Finance. Today, my esteemed colleague John D'Agostino and I welcome our guest Andrew Hirsch. We're excited to have Andrew. He represents a perspective that may not be that of mine and John's. He started in the crypto space, finding himself interested in it at a very young age. So as much as it looks like he doesn't need to borrow my razor, he may have a, don't let that deceive you. Yeah. So don't let his boyish good looks throw you off on that.
So talking about me or Andrew, who are you talking about?
Well, you know what? This is not a show about narcissism today. It's a show about Andrew. It's about AH, since we're going to go with like slang names here. By the way, do you have like a crypto handle?
I do. I do actually. When I first got into crypto, I actually used, it was my gaming handle. It was, funny enough, there was this Chinese ping pong player. He was the world champion at the time. His name was Wang Lekin. And that is my crypto handle, actually. So I go by, you know, Wang in some circles. And people always ask me, you know, they don't know me and they never see a picture. They say, are you Chinese? And I say, no, actually, I'm a Jewish kid from New York. So
now you're bringing Seinfeld into this, where Elaine was taking advice from somebody, Laura Chang. Yeah. Because she thought she was Asian, and then she wasn't Asian, and then that whole advice was called into question.
That's funny. All right, so Andrew, you answered my first question, which was going to be let's go back 10 years. You said you've been crypto for 10 years, so you're 24 now. You were 14 when you got into it, and a lot of people on the early days of Bitcoin got into it off of gaming and specifically boards. Let's take us back then, like. You know, tell us, you're a 14-year-old kid. Like, tell us a bit about yourself back then. Were you super into computers casually? Were you a young, gifted programmer? Like, how technically astute were you? Well, take us back to 14-year-old Andrew. And I guess that would be 2014-ish. I'm not sure who was popular back then. We got to Google which singer was popular. But walk us through, who were you at 14 that you got into this stuff so early?
Yeah. So when I was about 13 or 14, I got really into computers. So YouTube was really big back then. It was just starting to really become a really popular place to post videos, and channels were really starting to blow up. So I started, you know, following a bunch of these, you know, technology YouTubers. You know, one of the big ones was Linus Tech Tips. He's still huge today. But this is back when he was a bit smaller. And I basically got really interested in learning how a computer works, you know, what actually, you know, is going on the inside, and how to build a computer. So when I was about 13, 14, I built my first computer. It was a gaming PC, and started getting really into gaming and computers, and then really, you know, the technology side of things. And then from there, kind of developed this, you know, interest in the, you know, other side of computers, you know, like what is the real idea behind, like how did people think of like, okay, we have, you know, this box, but what can we actually do with the computer? And that kind of led me down this path of thinking about what is actually, you know, possible in the future. You know, we kind of saw, obviously, computers develop, you know, in my lifetime, more to mobile phones and mobile devices. But we got to the point where I was really, really curious on, you know, future applications of computers. You know, there were rumblings about quantum computing, all this stuff. And I would browse, you know, message boards, forums. And as this was going on and I was gaming, I also was a big Counter-Strike player, which was a very popular game at the time. And in Counter-Strike, there are these items, there were skins, basically really early NFTs that you could buy and sell through the Steam marketplace. And there were these gaming...
Steam. You did this through Steam.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, yeah. Steam is a platform for gaming that you can update your software versions. You buy your games to switch a computer. It's sort of like your games are on the cloud.
Correct, exactly. And the company that owns Steam is called Valve. And one of their big games, you know, not directly, they were helped in create Counter-Strike. So they created, you know, this whole universe of these skins that were tradable. And these people figured out that you could basically make gambling sites surrounding them, because some of the skins, you know, were quite valuable. People were paying, you know, $1,000-$2,000 for these skins. All of these gambling sites operated on crypto. So that was kind of my first taste of how you could, you know, kind of use online money. And this is, you know, obviously PayPal was a thing, but Venmo wasn't a thing back then. Really, no one was using Venmo.
Right. You know, but how'd you buy the crypto?
Okay. So this was actually a funny story. So I was shopping at a supermarket, Holiday Farms, with my mom, and I saw this ATM, and it didn't look like a regular ATM, and it was a Coinstar ATM, and it was actually a Bitcoin ATM in the supermarket that I walked over to and was really interested in. And
2014.
yes, correct. In
Okay. It was a
2014.
progressive supermarket.
I mean, whoever paid to put it in there, I guess, was really early to the game, but there was a Bitcoin ATM in there in 2014. And that's actually how I bought my first Bitcoin through the Bitcoin ATM. Little did I know that there was a very small cap. You could only buy $200 unless you had an ID. And I, as a 14-year-old, could not verify my ID. I didn't have a driver's license.
You hadn't stolen one at that point in time. We understand.
Correct.
So did you have the money, or you had to ask your parents for the money?
So I had some money saved up from birthdays and various other things. So I bought, about $200 worth of Bitcoin, and used it to, kind of buy skins and play the gambling games on these skins.
What'd your parents say? Did they know that you were buying $200 worth of Bitcoin?
They didn't know at this
They
point.
didn't know.
They
Okay.
didn't
What do you
know.
think they
By the way,
would
he
have
since
said?
bought his parents' house and he kicked them out, but we'll leave that story for another time.
What do you think they would have said?
I think they would have said that I'm an idiot for gambling, probably, and they probably wouldn't have been thrilled.
Okay.
I
Buy
mean,
the Bitcoin, and your goal with the goal to own this Bitcoin at the time was not because you necessarily believed in Bitcoin. It was a means to an end
correct.
because you wanted to speculate on skins. Did you want to speculate, or were there skins you wanted to buy for
No,
yourself?
I wanted to buy them, and I wanted to, also, try and gamble my way up. You could take basically like a $3 skin, and they
Okay.
had all these various games that you could gamble it up to, $100 skin or something. So I
Got
was doing
it.
some
Okay.
of that.
But the end goal at this time was not to make fiat
Correct.
money. It was to play in the skin universe and be a part of that community.
Correct, correct.
Got it. Okay.
So I got really into CSGO, and then fast forward about 2, 3 years,
So what's CSGO?
CSGO is Counter-Strike, the game. That's
Okay. So you
the acronym, sorry.
became a part of this community. You're on the message boards. You're okay. Got it.
So, and I was always, aware of Bitcoin, and I had some, I had some coins through the skin site and had them stored in the skin site, but I never really thought of it as an investment. I just thought of it as a, hey, this is an easy way for me to pay for these skins. I don't have a credit card. I don't even have a driver's license. This is an easy way for me to use things, and do these kind of online transactions. And I always thought it was cool that you can kind of transact with people you'd never met. You never knew, you didn't know their name. You just knew, their anonymous username. But that was kind of
And Counter-Strike, the server, that was the custodian, that was the vault that kept the keys.
So the actual site, like there was one called CSGO Rolls. There were a bunch of these different gambling sites that were actually the custodians for the crypto. And then
Okay.
they would hold the skins as well. And then when you wanted to withdraw, you would basically give them your account and they would send the skin to your account.
But
If that
that so that you had a what you could send them to a wallet. When you say account, what do you mean?
The skins aren't actually NFTs. So basically the way the Steam marketplace works is there is, it's all on a centralized server. You have a Steam account and it's tied
Okay.
to your to the game, and you can trade between accounts. Like there was a function where I could send skins to someone else, gift them or trade them. So
Okay.
basically they took advantage of that function and used that to transfer skins to people.
And were these skins, like when you bought a skin, did you know, okay, there's only 10,000 of these, or was there data on the skin to show you how scarce they were?
There was data. It was community driven data. It wasn't, they didn't release the data. And it was all community driven. And there was some actual pretty in-depth analytics about, like float of skins, how many skins are out there, like the average price. There was charts. It got pretty involved and pretty financialized, I'd say. So I did that for about a year or two. And then fast forward to when I was about 16 years old, 15, 16 years old. And I was not the best kid in high school. I was a troublemaker. And I wanted to buy alcohol. To buy alcohol, you need a fake ID. So I started digging in and figuring out how can I get a fake ID? I was going through Reddit, all these different message boards, forums, and I found the dark web. Luckily for me, I already had some experience with Bitcoin at this point. I was, relatively experienced as far as those days go. I'd sent transactions. I bought Bitcoin through a Bitcoin ATM. I wanted to go ahead and get one. So I went to the Bitcoin ATM to go purchase some more Bitcoin and use that to buy my first fake ID off the dark web. And
You had
that
a Tor browser. You did the Tor
Tor
browser.
browser, Onion Link, the whole nine yards. And I bought this ID from Vietnam or Thailand or wherever it came from. It was $20 or something, and which at the time was like 0.03 Bitcoin or something. But
Have you done the math yet on how much you spent on that fake ID?
I've done the math, and it was about, like, today's money, it was probably about $800, $700, which is not ideal.
Yeah.
But that kind of introduced me to more of the nefarious side of crypto.
What else did you see?
So I learned a bit about PGP encryption, how that was basically how most, vendors and customers communicated. They would encrypt. We're very cyberpunk back then still. It's very, we are, all about privacy and anti-government. And that was still a big theme in the crypto. And all these vendors were very, very shrouded and secret. So I definitely learned a lot about encryption and how to, communicate using PGP encryption and how to kind of, use these marketplaces. And there was all kinds of stuff. You could get everything from, a pound of weed to, a mini AK-47. They had everything on there.
Were you on Silk Road?
So I didn't end up actually buying anything off Silk Road myself. I had seen it and I'd gone on the site before. What I did buy stuff off of Alphabay, which was a later market after Silk Road got shut down. So it was one of the, first of that second generation of marketplaces, I'd say. And that was kind of my real introduction to crypto and figuring out, okay, this has a real use case.
But initially, it sounds like it gave you a form of independence at a younger age, and it wasn't really being supervised to the degree your parents might have wanted to supervise it. And I'm not casting judgment, but I'm casting a sense of what drove the interest in it, so that as viewers listen to you, they may understand why this seems to be so supported by more youthful people than any other group. And now it's become more institutionalized, but let's keep going.
So yeah, I mean, I was, like I said, I was definitely a troublemaker in school. I liked to, push the limits. And when I was, 15, 16 years old, I had an older brother, 2 years older. So I kind of saw him. He was, 16, 17 at the time. He was going out with his friends. He was, starting to go to parties and drink. And I, wanted to be cool and I wanted to drink. So I, took it upon myself, to kind of go and figure out, okay, how can I do this? And that was kind of that first, light bulb moment of like, okay, I can, without knowing anyone's name, independently transact and send and receive, money for goods, make a transaction with someone, in Thailand or Vietnam or China, halfway across the world, instantly that I can send them money. There's no, bank watching over me. There's no, you need an SSN. There's no, tax information. It's, true free commerce across borders with no limitations. That was what it was at the time. And I thought that was frankly really, really cool. Because I didn't think there was anything in the world, ever, frankly, up to that point in time that enabled that capability. I mean, even today, it's the only thing I think, in my opinion, that really allows you to have true unfettered access to these libertarian ideals of, free trade and free commerce. And again, people might not agree with what was actually being sold and bought, but at the end of the day, the principle really stuck with me.
And that's a very, very astute point you just made. I think sometimes we get caught up, and I think a lot of listeners, especially listeners of a certain age, will focus most of what they're hearing you, most of what they're going to hear from you is illegal activity. So, and I think you're bringing the nuance of the freedom of it as a separate for the. So I'm curious, was there any non-illegal activity occurring on the dark web? Was every single thing you could do there technically in breach of a law, or were like, could you buy flowers?
No, so everything wasn't illegal. There's definitely, legal things. People sold, real services. Obviously, you hear the stories about people selling hitmen, but people actually sold, I used to see, listings for like consultancy services for their business, for online digital marketing. People actually Sold some things, and there's some very famous crypto investors, Rand Nair and all these people from way back in 2013, 2014, of stories of them, going out on a limb and trying to accept Bitcoin for their business. There's the famous Bitcoin pizza story. So it wasn't all illicit, but I do think that the ideals at the time that the space, the cyberpunk ideals of, F the government, we don't want, Big Brother watching over us, kind of led to that crowd that was definitely more predisposed to use this for illicit purposes. And at the end of the day, it was so new, and no one in, government really knew how to, watch anything at the time, especially in the early days of Silk Road, that it was easy to do these illicit transactions through it, and it was much safer than, selling drugs in the street. Because no one was looking, no one knew where to look, no one knew Silk Road was a thing, no one knew Alphabay was a thing. So I think that kind of.
We talk about safety there from authorities. It's also safer for you. Hell of a lot safer to order. I mean, you may get scammed, but versus going to a drug dealer with a wad of cash to purchase drugs. I don't want my 14-year-old kid buying drugs. But if they're gonna do it, I'd much rather them do it that way than heading someplace unsafe with a wad of cash. So that's the argument I heard, that in support of Ross, in support of Silk Road, was that he was providing, or that was providing, a safe way for people to do things they were going to do anyway.
I mean, I will say 100%. Silk Road, Alphabay, all these marketplaces, they were like Amazon. These vendors had hundreds of reviews. People would go out and, they would post videos in their reviews. They would wear a mask and they'd post videos of them drug testing the sample that they just received to prove to everyone that it is real. And then they would rate it. And, it was, at the end of the day, a pretty safe way to, get these substances and conduct this business. You weren't, like you said, there was no, guy who may or may not have a weapon who could, try and rob you. There was, for the most part, not that much scamming. I mean, there was exit scamming, which was popular, where a vendor would, be a vendor for 2 years, one of the most successful, would have, thousands of five-star reviews, and then decide he's out of the game. And he wouldn't just, shut down his site. He would, take a bunch of orders, not fulfill them, and then leave. That was really the only vector of scams that I really saw.
If you had to put a percentage on it, it's an unfair question, but in your experience doing it, like, what percentage was fraud? Like, for every 100 orders I put in, what would you assume on a percentage basis I should assume? Like, by the way, Temu, I'm addicted to Temu. I'm addicted. I assume about 10 to 15% of what I get is going to be effectively fraud. So it's going to be crap, right? Just absolute crap. What do you think the ratio was of fraud on the dark web?
I think it was probably about 5%, honestly. I think it was
Wow.
very low.
Wow.
I really think, I mean, listen, there were definitely vendors, like there were vendors that would pop up that would have no reviews that you could tell, you probably shouldn't be ordering from. But if you were ordering from, a vendor who had, any significant amount, 50, 100 reviews, I very, very, very rarely saw like serious fraud. And at least from the reviews, of these products, people seemed very, very, very happy with the service they were receiving. Prices were very fair. And it seemed like, a healthy marketplace. Again, you can question whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to be able to buy and sell, illicit substances and whatever else. But at its core, again, it was, true libertarianism in, all of its, glory. And it worked very well. People were very happy, and obviously the government wasn't very happy, but I think it's as far as, true open marketplaces go, it was a shining example of people really aren't actually that bad. You know what I mean? People
Did you
have
know at
an
14 what a
ego.
libertarian was? Did you identify as libertarian at 14?
I mean, I didn't know what it was at the time. When I was maybe 16, I started to really understand what a libertarian was. And I definitely am one. But when I was 14, I kind of just knew what I felt and what I thought. And I was, always a very heavily opinionated kid, but I didn't know what to call it. I just knew that, listen, if two consenting adults want to do X, Y, Z, whatever, and they're not hurting anyone else, they should be allowed to do that. Doesn't really, I don't have a problem with that. You know what I mean? That was
How
kind of my.
much of a libertarian are you? So do you think we should have any drug laws? Any at all, should everything be legal, or are you more for like reforming drug laws?
I think that, we need to, I don't think that all, I don't think any drug should be illegal. I think that they should be, carefully monitored. Like, I think Portugal is
So
a
you're
decent.
saying, wait a minute, you're saying you don't have an issue with crack?
I have no issue if, listen, if a consenting adult wants to take crack, I have no problem with it. I would prefer that the crack that they're getting is purchased from a reliable source, something that's tested, something that is not containing fentanyl, which is obviously a huge issue nowadays. And listen, I believe very strongly that if you are an adult of sound mind and you are, 25 years old and you are not harming anyone else, you should be able to do whatever you want.
I
I
know
really
you just, but
do.
this is the lawyer in me. You qualified it by saying sound mind. So then it causes me to question who determines who is of sound mind and who isn't. And I'm not looking for an answer on that, but I want to continue the conversation, not stay mired in the teenage year, the
Yes.
wonder years. So I want to
Yes.
move on to a little bit
I
to.
agree. I just want to say I admire Andrew. I'm not on the same page as you there, but I admire your consistency. What I don't like are libertarians whose argument breaks down to become hypocritical of their own position. So while you and I may disagree, I admire your thoughtfulness of taking it to that extreme of saying even crystal meth should be allowed. I admire that. I really do. You have conviction in your belief, and you might be right. I might be wrong, but I think that's a good thing. So sorry, Ron. Please let's move
Yeah,
on.
no worries. So, all right. So now, what is the next stage of your evolution in connection with your relationship with cryptocurrencies?
Correct.
So this
So.
continues until what time, and do you have, and what triggers this change, or either you're getting deeper, you're becoming more sophisticated.
Yeah. So about 2017 rolls around, and obviously you guys know 2017 was the year of the ICO. This was, when Ethereum was just birthed, and it was very, very, very popular to launch a random project on Ethereum or one of a number of other blockchains at the time. And, a lot of these projects were scams, and did not deliver. And I think this is where, the crypto industry really got that kind of, bad rep of being filled with fraud and scammers, was this era. But I was, very interested at the time. And this was, I was 16, 17. I'd been, involved in the space for, a couple of years at this point. And I went to my dad and I said, "Dad, there's really cool things happening with crypto here. I think we should get involved." And there was a lot of back and forth. He said, "Nah, it's all for, illicit substances and doing drugs and drug dealers and
Maybe
scammers."
he was watching your computer quietly and you didn't know
I was going to say when he's saying that and you're like, "No, Dad, it's not." Are you thinking like,
it.
"Ew,
So let's go to the lie detector
I
room.
was like, not only for that, there is that, but not only. But yeah, I said, listen, we should, get involved. Let's, do some research. And I believe strongly that there's some future here. And we bought, I think it was like $2,500 worth of ETH. ETH was, $200, $300 at this point.
By the way, you should call it ETH because E stands for ecstasy also. I don't want to
Yes.
confuse any of our listeners.
ETH,
Yeah.
Ethereum.
Wait,
And
this is pre-DAO hack? Is this ETH 1 or ETH 2.0?
no, this is just after. This is just
Okay.
after. And we bought, a bunch of ETH, and we took that and we kind of fired a cannon out into a bunch of different ICOs. You can all guess how that turned out. But this was kind of that first step in kind of realizing the underlying potential of blockchain technology as a whole, and not just expanding past Bitcoin and going into, okay, these are smart contracts. These are really, really cool. They enable a lot of really cool behavior. I want to see what they can do. And one of the big ones I remember that we invested in was called EverX. And basically, their whole idea was they were going to do cross-border payments and remittance. And I thought this was a great idea. And I still think to this day, this is one of crypto's best use cases and best ideas. Again, this was before stable coins were really a popular thing. No one, there really were no stable coins at the time that were in use. And I thought, this is a great idea. I think this has real potential. Let's invest. Obviously, you don't know, you, no one's ever heard of EverX today. It went to zero. But that kind of really sparked my interest in thinking deeper about what the technology could be capable of and where we mm-hmm. could be, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years in the future from then.
Yeah, let's go. So it's about that time. So because you're obviously a believer in both the technology, but also the way in which blockchain will kind of change the way we order ourselves societally. Mm-hmm. And your experiment of buying ETH and investing in a bunch of failed ICOs, let's just be honest, fails. Even though I'm sure you're disappointed in that failure, it solidified your belief. How did your dad feel at the time?
My dad was not as much on board. So he, you know, I talked him into it and he kind of understood and he thought there was potential. You know, he'd been listening to me, you know, offhand mention Bitcoin since it was $300, $400, $500 a coin. And he, I think he definitely thought there was, you know, potential to, you know, make a ton of money. I think that's what we all thought.
But then the ICOs all go to zero. And what is he like, oh, I learned something about the potential from this. Or he's like, listen, idiot.
He's like, this is dumb. You know, it's all for fraud scams. Everyone was right. That was saying it's all fraudsters scams. You know, I was right. It's all for, you know, scammers. Right. I'm done with this.
That's an important inflection point, by the way. So I want to understand, like, do you think the reason you took that failure as a learning experience and that you built on your belief versus your father, is that an age thing? Is that a comfort with technology thing? Is he more a believer?
Well, what do you think the triumph is? John, you're leading the witness here, buddy.
I want to explain my question. Like, why do you think you took that from it and he took the, haha, I told you so.
So I think it's definitely a couple things. I think A, you know, it's an age and experience with technology thing. You know, this was, I grew up, you know, I was 7 years old when the iPhone came out. I grew up with an iPod in my hand. You know, I grew up on the internet. The internet, I've not existed at a point in my life. I've never been alive where the internet wasn't a thing. And I've always thought, you know, it's so ingrained in my life. How could this just seems like a next logical evolution for him? I think, you know, he's, you know, a bit older, obviously. And I think it was harder for him to grasp at the time that, you know, this made sense and that you could basically, you know, build what was probably the most traditional, you know, siloed, cordoned off industry that was, you know, Wall Street, that you could kind of build that all online. You know, again, this was just at the beginning of when real fintech companies were getting really popular and becoming really valuable, you know, in the last couple of years at that point. And it was still, you know, there was no idea of like, our entire lives are going to be on the phone and nothing else. And I think, you know, his viewpoint was that, you know, listen, this was, you know, a big grift and there might be some innovation. Bitcoin might be a little cool, but I don't think it's going to actually replace anything. Whereas for me, I had also grown up, you know, using it at this point. I was, you know, 3-4 years into using it. And I think that I saw, again, that libertarian mindset of this is a great way to conduct commerce. This is a no-brainer in my eyes of why are we doing things like this through banking apps where I have to, you know, go in person and make a withdrawal when I can do everything on my phone, never have to meet anyone. And, you know, the smart contract piece was kind of just that next step of like, this enables these more complex functions for us to be done. It's not just I can send money and he can send it back. We can escrow, you know, we can, you know, insure certain things. We can do collateralized lending. We can do all this kind of different stuff. And I think he, you know, didn't really understand that at the time and was more hesitant to believe that anything, you know, could take even a small chunk out of the, you know, market share of Wall Street and the traditional finance.
I want to think a bit deeper into this because I think what I'm hearing from you, because the reality is even today, but certainly back then, it wasn't easier. And you said you were 17, 18, so you probably could open up a checking account. And even though this was probably pre-Venmo, it wasn't easier to do crypto. Like it's not.
It wasn't as accessible to the public as
anyone today. Even if you were technically astute, the act of sending someone crypto was and is still harder than using Venmo. We agree, right, Liz? So your argument to your dad, it really seems to hinge on your it's not so much you were impressed with the tech. You were impressed with the potential of tech, but what you really are impressed by was the ability of this tech to get around traditional finance. It really seems to hinge on your libertarian belief, not so much your preference for that specific technology.
I'm going to take a slightly different position because it's harder to assess what his father's going through. But the reality is, the older you get, in most cases, the more risk adverse a person becomes because they're more aware of all the things that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. So I founded Sadus at 30 with $30,000 in business. You've started your business a little older in life, John. So you were more aware of this and you've started other businesses. I had no awareness of all the things that could go wrong. I didn't have a way of truly putting it in perspective. So I think that plays a role in why there's such a strong paradigm shift between that and the fear of all the different things that can go wrong.
I think that's a great point. Andrew, I think what we're saying is it's easier for a 17-year-old to imagine a radically different world than it is for a 35 or above person to imagine a radically different world. Is that fair, Ron?
Yeah, of course. But now, so bring us, because the conversation is really helpful because it might enable the Gen Zs, the Gen Xers to put it in perspective. Because truthfully, while you have had different life experiences, growing up always with the existence of the internet, and John and I don't have that experience. Fundamentally, humans are humans. And as you age, you may find that you start to shift more in alignment on certain subjects with your parents. And that's not necessarily the focus. This is not a sociological study. But I want to get to what is your relationship now in the cryptocurrency industry?
Yep.
And where do you think it's going?
Okay. So this is my favorite topic to talk about nowadays, especially that second part, where I think it's going. So I guess
that's a little bit of a sad admission, but you know what? I'm not going to bust your chops now.
So like I mentioned earlier, when we were talking before, I did some research for SkyBridge over summer. And then as I was doing that, I got really, into NFTs. I had been, really interested in crypto ever since that kind of ICO bubble burst. And I, saw, the DeFi summer kind of kick off and dabbled in crypto through that and played around with all the different technology. And that kind of really reinvigorated my spirit of, we can do great things with this technology. It has a ton of potential. And then that kind of led right into the NFT summer, which I was very interested in. Again, this ties back to that Counter-Strike story of, we have these digital objects that are, usable in game that can be traded between users that may have value. Steam, the big problem with Steam was if you got banned from the game for whatever reason, or if you forgot your password, or if they launched, Counter-Strike 2, a new game, all your old stuff was worthless. So the idea of the NFTs was you actually fully
forked. It was a hard fork.
Exactly. You own this tokenized representation that can't be taken from you and can never be, forked out of use, essentially. And that really resonates.
So if I own an NFT from a game and then the game changes or a new game becomes popular, I can still own that NFT. It doesn't get taken away from me. But if it doesn't have a home in that new game, what's the value of it?
So the value, exactly. The value only extends to as far as whoever is creating the game or the universe, as far as they let it. But the idea at the time, the potential, we always focus on the potential in crypto and on
it. Okay.
Exactly. So the idea that was really flowing through everyone's mind was, what if Valve, Steam, who ran this massive library of games, decided we're going to take our skins for this game and we're going to let you use those skins in every game we make. You know what I mean? And you could transfer them across game and you own it. You own the asset. You can use it in whatever game you want, any game, it doesn't matter.
And the gaming companies had to be open to that.
On board, exactly.
And they were. It sounds like they were. This is the value of letting
meaning open over. Architecture.
Yeah. So they definitely, some of them definitely were. Again, crypto was at this point just coming back into focus after the ICO era, and people were still definitely hesitant. But I think there were a lot of developers in the space who saw the idea and the potential. And the true people who loved gaming loved the idea, whereas the more businessmen of the gaming companies didn't love the idea as much, because that meant, you know, we can't sell as many skins. You know, if we launch a new game, we get to resell all the skins. We get to sell everyone new skins for the new game, and we get to print money. So this was kind of a contentious subject back and forth. But back to the point of this. So I got into NFTs, thought it was a really cool idea, and thought it was an interesting idea. And I found an NFT project that was very early. It was one of the first projects to launch after the Bored Apes, which I'm sure you've heard of. And this was about a week or two after they launched. And I, you know, joined the project. They minted, and they needed help. And I saw that they needed help. And I said, listen, I've been around, you know, crypto and gaming for a long time. I think I can help you guys. Let's hop on a call. They agreed. I became, you know, employee number one and helped grow the business to about $40-50 million in revenue in that first year and a half. We did everything from sponsoring a big three basketball team in the basketball tournament on ESPN every year. And we went, you know, all the way the other side of, okay, you know, we worked with Puma and LaMelo Ball to launch a custom shoe that was in collaboration with the NFT collection. So we kind of did the whole birth of IRL, you know, gaming, everything, and kind of tied it all. And that was honestly some of the most fun I've ever had in the industry, and kind of seeing the potential of, okay, you know, the technology is great, but there's also a community aspect here too. And people, you know, obviously want to belong and be a part of something. And I thought that the NFTs actually really let people, you know, show their true self and you know, semi-anonymously and be a part of a community of like-minded individuals that shared these similar beliefs on, you know, economics, freedom, you know, a lot of time politics. So it was definitely a really cool space to be a part of. But that was...
Sorry, keep going. I thought you were pausing.
No, that was kind of my 2021 cycle, interest in crypto and where I spent my time. And, you know, we always thought, you know, all the nation states are buying, you know, El Salvador used to buy Bitcoin, and we thought, you know, it was going to come. Obviously, it didn't come at the time. But that takes us to now, where I think we're at a really, really interesting inflection point, where we have a government in the United States that is open and friendly to crypto for the first time in my entire life. You know, if you told me 10 years ago that the United States government would be talking about a strategic Bitcoin reserve, I would have laughed harder than you could never believe. But I think it's really interesting to see, you know, powerful people, you know, who have real power in this country, who can make change, who can lay the ground for this industry to become something real in America, really have a change of heart over the last, you know, year or two, and come out and say, okay, you know, we want to support this. We want to build for this. We want to have an SEC that allows, you know, crypto companies to build without fear of, you know, without fear of retribution from the government for, you know, not following rules that don't exactly exist, or anything like that.
So Andrew, some of the folks who I talk to, and I'm a couple of different WhatsApp groups, and some of them are very, very heavy Bitcoin maxi, crypto maxi, blockchain maxi, hyper-libertarian people. And I've seen a position amongst some of them, which is surprising to me. They're against the SBR. And the reason they're against the SBR is that they view it as a co-opting of the movement.
Why don't you slow down what you're discussing?
I don't want to oversimplify their argument, but if I had to, I would say that their argument basically boils down to, as you said in the beginning, the genesis of this is anti-government. The genesis of this is not needing the government to be involved. And an SBR, and by the way, some of them are very public. Nick Carter is, for example, on Twitter. He's very public about this. And their argument is simply, we don't want the government involved. And the worst thing that can happen to Bitcoin is that it gets the stamp of approval from a government, because by definition, then it will be co-opted and it will, yeah. And so I'm just kind of curious. I'm just curious, given what you've said before about your core beliefs, how do you react to that view?
So, yeah, I mean, that's obviously a really big point of contention right now is kind of for the OGs, so to speak. And I really hate calling myself that because I really don't feel like one. But, you know,
we're in the club, man.
You know, it's okay. I'm very libertarian. I do not want government oversight. I do not want government running Bitcoin. However, I do understand that if this technology is going to change the world and is going to be, you know, widely used and accepted all across the world, we do need support from some governments. And that doesn't mean that we need them to manage the network. We don't need them to make rules. I'd prefer if they don't make any rules, generally, because I'm a libertarian. I don't expect that to happen. But in my ideal world, a strategic Bitcoin reserve is fine. I'm fine with the government acquiring Bitcoin, you know, and holding Bitcoin. There's no problem with that for me. It doesn't affect the network in any way. It doesn't affect the security of the network. And it doesn't, you know, scare me into thinking that they are, you know, going to try and shut it down. It's actually quite the opposite. I think if they're purchasing Bitcoin, it kind of shows that they believe that this has a future. You know, something that does scare me is a central bank digital currency, which the current administration has been very vocal that they are not at any point planning to allow, which is, you know, music to my ears. That,
so why does it scare you?
So a central bank digital currency is essentially the epitome of a security state in my eyes. You know what I mean? It goes against all of the ideals that got me into crypto, you know, that free trade, unsupervised, you know, kind of transfer of assets.
It would allow for just so the audience understands, like the position you're saying, because the technology would allow governments to completely control money supply down to the level of being able to shut off your wallet. Exactly. You can argue they can do that now, but they have to go, you know, the court order, and they have to go to a bank, and you can use cash, but they would be able to without, you know, theoretically, because arguably Chris Giancarlo and others who support CBDCs say, well, the same laws would apply. But let's assume you have a bad tyrannical government. They would have total control over your money, right? That's the point, yes, right?
Exactly. They could, you know, at will shut down my account. They could prevent transfers. You know, we kind of see a similar, you know, version of this today in stablecoins like USDC and USDT, where the centralized authority Tether or Circle does have the ability to freeze stablecoins, and they will do this when, you know, these coins are involved in a hack or some type of illicit transaction. They will freeze the coins, and you know, I think there are use cases for a stablecoin that can be frozen, and I think, you know, if we want to see this, you know, plethora of financial activity move to blockchains, you do need to have some safeguards like this. And I'm completely understanding of that. But for me, I would like Bitcoin to remain as unblemished and uncontrollable as possible and uncensorable as possible, because that was really at its core what got me in. I don't think, you know, the government simply acquiring Bitcoin, you know, impinges on my ability or on Bitcoin's ability to be that uncensorable network. Something that would be much more concerning would be if the government was taking that money and investing in serious mining power to control.
My next question was to ask you, how would you feel? Because there's also been rumblings about this notion of wanting the Bitcoin network to be American. I'm not sure what that means per se, but one interpretation could mean we want everything running off of miners.
I interpret it as more control.
It's not unreasonable, but at a minimum, you would argue, I want the Bitcoin here, but I also want the transaction network to be run on American servers, right? It's not a stretch to think that would fall under Bitcoin being American, right?
I think that's how I take the sentiment, especially from Trump and the administration, is, you know, they are suggesting that, you know, listen, I'm, you know, I love America. I want us to, you know, be a leader in crypto. And I think, you know, we're finally at a place where we can. But I think that for the sake of the network, we need to be cautious because, yes, you know, we do want, you know, a lot of these miners to be in America, on American soil, American companies owned by American, you know, public shareholders. But it creates hesitancy when, you know, let's say hypothetically 75% of all the hash rate in the world is centralized in America, mm-hmm. and a president comes in that doesn't necessarily agree with my libertarian ideals of how the Bitcoin network should be run, and, you know, compels these American companies who still have to follow the laws of the nation,
yep.
to, you know, bend to the government's will, whatever that might be. So that's why, again, I'm a big proponent of decentralization. And I think that we can build in America, and we can make Bitcoin a big part of America's future. But we need to, for the health and sake of the network, all the participants, even the American ones, need mm-hmm. to make sure that decentralization is still a key tenet. And we can't sacrifice decentralization for profit.
So there
will be no profit.
So pause for a second. So what advice would you give President Trump if he dials you up tomorrow as it relates to cryptocurrency?
I mean, you're about the age of everybody who's making decisions about how we spend our money as a government. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that you can be making
decisions. Andrew, it's ring, ring.
Yeah. You're in Doge, man.
Andrew, this is Donald Trump. This is Donald Trump. What advice do you have to give to me?
So I think I would do, honestly, very, very close to the actions that they've taken to date. I actually, you know, as much as there's been a lot of, you know, talk in the crypto that they haven't done enough, I think that the expectations were wildly overblown going into, you know, the inauguration. And that's kind of why we've seen a bit of, you know, scale back on price along with macro. But I think, you know, buying an SBR, I love the idea of buying an SBR, not just because it, you know, pumps our bags, but I also think that if Bitcoin, you know, on the off chance that Bitcoin does become, you know, the world reserve currency, mm-hmm. if you don't hold any Bitcoin as a nation, you are going to be in big trouble. You know, the reason the United States has been so successful for so long is because, and why we've reached this global superpower status, is because we have the world reserve. We have the world reserve currency. We have the petrodollar, and we can always lean back on that and our military might to enforce, you know, the United States world order that we've kind of seen for the last 70 years.
Well, not for free anymore, apparently.
Well, that's changing. You know, I think it's really interesting because I would probably take very, very, very similar actions. You know, buying an SBR, budget neutral, because I'm...
By the way, SBR, for those who don't know what it means, is strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Yes. So funding the SBR through budget neutral activities, you know, it could be selling gold. It could be, you know, maybe taking some of the Doge savings. I don't know. But through budget neutral activities, which is what they suggested, and also not selling any of the forfeited and seized Bitcoin, which is a whole nother discussion. I'm not a big fan of civil asset forfeiture laws, libertarian, but
your dad is a litigator, may not like that position.
I'm sure he will love that comment. But, you know, again, I would do the same thing probably. You know, we have a ton of Bitcoin.
Do we know that a lot of the Bitcoin was seized through civil asset forfeiture, or was it through criminal activity? Do you see a difference between those two?
So I do see a difference between those two, and I know a lot was through civil asset forfeiture.
It was
most.
Okay. I didn't know.
Most is it's probably, I have to go look at the exact numbers. It's not a majority. The majority came from Silk Road and Ross. That's where most of the United States Bitcoin came from, mm-hmm. and other, you know, illicit activities. We have, I think it's like 190,000, if I'm not mistaken, Bitcoin. Allegedly, no one's done an audit. We have no idea. But if we hold them to their word, we have a lot of Bitcoin already. I think that not only does the United States having Bitcoin signal that we are, you know, ready to move forward as an industry and ready to build crypto businesses in America, but I think it also signals to the rest of the world that we are taking this seriously. You need to as well. And in effect, kind of creates this, you know, network effect of states that are going to want to hold Bitcoin because we hold Bitcoin. You know, we put trust in something, they could probably afford to put trust in something now. So I think it that creates a domino almost of, you know, adoption around the world, where other nations are a lot more likely to embrace the technology now. So
go ahead, Ron.
Well, one other thing I want to highlight, you may not realize it. You use the word in one response, we. And it's interesting because you, by using the word we, it's an indication that you're viewing yourself as part of a community in the crypto space. And I'm not sure, you're shaking your head, which is in support of it. So can you explain what you mean by we? Because sometimes I feel like a them and not a we.
Yes. So, I mean, really when I mean we, I mean, as an American citizen that wants the best outcome for the nation. You know, I love America and I truly believe it's, you know, the greatest country in the world. And I want to see it, you know, succeed and be successful for the next 250 years. And I do believe, obviously, we have differing views. You know, I'm libertarian, someone may be democratic, someone may be very conservative. We all have differing views on differing issues. But at the end of the day, what makes this country great is that we can all agree that we are American and we are one people. And, you know, if someone were to attack us or if someone wants, you know, to wish the downfall of America, we all band together and support it. And I think that at the end of the day, we as Americans are a family. And I think, you know, the crypto community kind of considers them a similar family. At the end of the day, you know, there's Bitcoin maxis, there's altcoin maxis, there's meme coin traders. At the end of the day, we're all a family and we all want the best for the industry. So I think it's kind of, you know, the big American family. And then right now there's this little, you know, crypto family inside of that big American family. And I think it's growing and growing and growing. And I'd like to see one day the whole American family be that whole American crypto family and support, you know, what I think is potentially the future of finance in America and in the world.
One other question. So Atkins is chairman of the SEC, not in office yet. We expect he's going to liberalize to some degree the application of the securities laws definition to what a cryptocurrency is. Mm-hmm. Thereby, like we know, meme coins are not deemed to be a security now, right?
Yep.
Do you have an expectation in connection with things you're doing in crypto as to the steps you're hoping he takes or you expect him to take?
So I think, you know, listen, I've learned over the last 5-10 years in this industry that I can't ask for too much. You know, just even seeing that declaration from Hester Pierce and the rest of I forgot what the actual official name of the new commission in the SEC is, but that kind of working group to come out and say, you know, listen, we're a month into the administration and they came out and said, you know, we're going to be very clear. These meme coins are not securities. They've never met the definition of securities for the last 10 years. You know what I mean? They've never been securities, but the previous administration has been so hesitant to actually give rulemaking and any type of guidance as to what may or may not be a security that I'm just ecstatic to even see that. And I'm very hopeful that that is a sign of coming out and stepping out on the right foot. I would love to see, you know, a sort of, you know, I wasn't alive for this back in the dot-com era, really, and I was very young. But I'd like to see sort of something similar to that where they create this kind of, you know, sandbox for innovation that allows these companies to play with, you know, topics and ideas that may, you know, teeter into securities. Because again, a lot of what the ultimate goal of the crypto industry is going to, you know, try and replace a lot of these securitized financial products. And again, you do need consumer protections and all that kind of stuff. I understand that, but I'd like to see us kind of open up the floodgates and allow for innovation and kind of see in a careful and responsible and monitored way what we can come up with and what we're actually able to do with the technology when we put, you know, our best minds in America incentivized to go after it and see what we can create and not hang the threat of, you know, legal repercussions over their head. Like when I was working for the NFT project, we had real concerns that the SEC was going to, there were pictures of cartoon cats and we had real concerns that the SEC was going to come after us and throw us in jail or fine us. You know what I mean?
I have a thought on that, but I want to ask this question while you're on the topic. So do you think that this new financial paradigm that's run on blockchain, which we really mean is quasi-decentralized, so shifting away from centralized forms of trust, do you think that largely replaces or exists side by side with the current financial system?
I think eventually it has real potential to replace. However, this kind of jumps back to that conversation of, you know, you're 35, you're 40. It's a lot harder for you to see the future in a radically different way than it was today. You know, people who are, you know, maybe even just 5 or 10 years older than me, you know, when you're 30, 35, are going to be very hesitant to fully move over. And even people my age who are not, you know, total believers in crypto and maybe don't understand the technology or don't support it, see it as scams and grifts and whatever. I think there's going to be a lot of hesitancy. And I think it's going to have to be side by side for probably 25, 30, maybe more years before people are really, you know, accepting of the technology and letting it move into to their life. I mean, even stuff like the iPhone, it's become ubiquitous now, of course, but it's taken, you know, 15, 20 years just since its release for you know, it to become really ubiquitous. And, you know, mobile phones took, you know, 20 years to really become ubiquitous. And, you know, technology, even when you have crazy jumps in technology, it's never this instant switch over. You know what I mean?
No, but it's moving faster and faster. If you look ever since the ATM, the absorption of technology into society is going at a faster pace. But to maybe make this for some people more relatable, if you're giving advice to somebody who's just starting to be comfortable with cryptocurrencies or wanting to become, what advice would you give to a neophyte?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, listen, what is most interesting to you? Do you like, you know, the, you know, whole libertarian freedom ideas and the idea of doing this, you know, decentralized commerce and anything else you want? Do you like the idea of, you know, having decentralized finance where, you know, you can do collateralized lending and you can do all this kind of, you know, cockamamie financial engineering to create these financial products? Like, I think there are, you know, are you a gambling junkie? There's plenty of gambling between meme coins and actual gambling sites like Stake. You know, there's plenty of ways where there are applications for different interests that you can jump into crypto. I think at the end of the day, it's I want people to use it and understand the technology, because I really do think once people use it, they will see that there is value here that is not replicated anywhere else. You know what I mean? There is, you know, real innovation. And listen, it might be disguised by, you know, dog with hat meme coin or fart coin or whatever. But at the end of the day, it really is, you know, innovative to allow, you know, there was never an ability for anyone to just create a investment vehicle or a coin and let anyone in the world, you know, invest and gamble on it.
So you're perceiving it as a shift of power from the man to Joe Public, or Jane Public.
Yes, I think it allows you to take more control of your finances. If you are interested in doing something, again, I know not everyone's interested in this. And some people, you know, just like putting money in their 401k, forgetting about it, going to work and living their life. And that's completely fine. But, you know, I do think that, you know, stuff like accredited investor laws are some of the most harmful things on the planet, some of the most predatory things on the planet for keeping the, you know, middle and low and lower income classes, you know, down essentially. And I understand that the idea of trying to protect them, but it's essentially saying, you know, you don't make $200,000 a year for the last 3 years and you don't have 2 million in liquid assets. You are dumb. You are too dumb to invest in these private asset classes. You are too dumb to invest in a hedge fund. You are too dumb to invest in private equity. You know, you are basically limiting these people to a specific set of financial products. And again, that goes against everything I believe in libertarianism, where, you know, I think you should be able to do whatever you want if you're not harming anyone else.
But
so Andrew, the only nuance I would suggest is that you can also argue that it's not so much targeting the buyer of those products, it's targeting the seller. Meaning the idea behind the rules are, we're gonna let you market this thing, and we're not going to make you go through all the rigmarole you would have to go. So we start with we've set up these protections for retail investors. And then people came along and said, I want to sell my investment product. I don't want to go through all that headache. That's a pain in the ass. And then the rules, okay, well, we'll let you sell without all the disclosures, all the protections, but then you can't access the retail market that we've set these rules up to protect. So the limitations can be viewed as being on the seller. I agree with you. Ultimately, the buyer is limited. Whether I stop short of saying they're harmed, because since 97% of these investments don't beat the S&P, you can make an argument that they're actually not harmed by investing in this stuff.
I agree.
I'll just end with this. I don't necessarily disagree with you. And other countries like Switzerland, they have a more of an opt-in model where they say to the investor, treat me like an adult. I want to be treated like I'm rich. And I give up protections because of that. And I think that's a better model. I think people should be allowed to make their own decisions. But I'll say this last part about this. I've been on lots of panels where I've heard the tokenization argument. And they've said, oh, we want to democratize finance. And my concern, Andrew, is that 9 out of 10 times, if I look at who's making that argument, it's a shitty hedge fund manager who can't sell his product anymore to institutional investors because he's not good at what he does. And what he's really saying, and what you said, a term predatory before, and my fear is that this will become predatory, because what he's really saying is, I've run out of smart money and I want to see if I can con retail who doesn't know that I suck at what I do.
It's a dumb money. And by the way,
all exit liquidity in crypto.
It's a bad way. You know what? You're right. Dumb money is a bad way to be. But Andrew, see my point? Like, my concern is that when you decrease the friction associated with this distribution and you drop all the rules, you let the sharks get after the fish. That's my fear, at least.
And by the way, that is the very reason why the federal securities laws were adopted in 1933, is after the 29 stock market crash. I spent my time at the SEC. I was in the enforcement division. And the laws are paternalistic in the United States, not just in securities. Look at pharma. You're a libertarian. Do you think there should be speed limits on the highway?
I think there shouldn't be. I like Germany's model of the Autobahn, and I think it's a great model, and you can go look at the data behind the accidents. We have a
About drinking at 21? Is that the right age? Should 10-year-olds be able to buy a handle a Jack?
Again, I think it should be 18. You can go fight and die for your country.
I'm trying to prove a point. Why 18 and not 15? Why are you deciding an 18-year-old is more aware than a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old?
I agree. And that's the toughest part about being a libertarian, is it's okay. Can you draw a line, and where do you draw a line? And personally, I would prefer to use some scientific basis, at least, for drawing the lines. You know, we can say, oh, there shouldn't be any speed limits on any road. That might be a little too far, especially for a lot of the public.
You're a thoughtful libertarian, and you're trying to solve a problem with, because I'm sure you would agree, libertarian is not perfect, no more than any other system is perfect. And you're acknowledging that it's not perfect, and I admire that. I mean, that's great. But what do you think about what I said regarding the potential predatory nature? I just want to get your response to that view.
So it's a big concern for me, honestly, because, you know, I think the last 6 months, even 3 months, honestly, kind of encapsulates your argument perfectly, because, you know, you have the Trump meme coin that comes out and it's all the rage, goes 70 billion, you know, the public's buying all this stuff. It starts to go down, and that's guaranteed to happen. You know, it still was trading, you know, 30 billion, which is enormous market cap. And, you know, as we kind of move down that euphoria roller coaster, people like to call it, of, you know, these big loops, and it gets smaller and smaller of these progressive launches, you get, you know, these predatory people who want to take advantage and want to get rich quick. And we've always had this in, you know, frankly, any new industry that is without regulation, but especially crypto, because it's so easy to make money quickly, where, you know, you have stuff like Melania comes out right after, and then you have stuff like Libra, which was more recent, about a month ago, where, you know, Javier Milei, frankly, you know, from my understanding, he got conned into, you know,
sounds like it, yeah,
being a part of this project by some, you know, shadier people in the industry who don't want to push the industry forward. They just want to make a quick buck, which is sad. But, you know, it's a real problem. And does clash with the libertarian ideals of everything should be allowed. You know, in a perfect world, everyone is, you know, able and aware and capable of making a wise decision, and, you know, no one gets hurt. This is not a perfect world, and that's not going to happen, and people are going to get hurt. I think we do need some form of consumer protections. I absolutely do. But I do think that you should, you know, be able to, like you were kind of saying, the Switzerland model, opt in, say, treat me as an adult. I am capable of making my own decisions. I'm okay with the potential losses. And, you know, at the end of the day, listen, if you want to opt in and make your decision to take that risk and, you know, opt into the system where there is, you know, bad actors, and you're prepared for that, be prepared to lose your money. That's fine. You're an adult. You're a big boy. You know, you can make those decisions, and not everything turns out well. And that's life. You know, I think where it becomes a problem is when you target people who do not understand the technology or the industry. Like when we market, you know, these meme coins to the public who has never bought a meme coin.
You keep saying we, by the way, when we.
The industry, market, yeah. We as an industry.
He's a part of, okay. He's saying he's part of crypto. He's saying right. We as crypto.
I hear you. I'm just trying to highlight there's it's a state of mind. Not bad or good.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I don't think of it as like it's us versus them. It's us as people who have been in the industry and have a better understanding of these things. And we're trying to trying to spread the gospel, so to speak. We're the missionaries of the faith, and we have to do a good job spreading it where people aren't going to want to join. You know what I mean? When you're parading meme coins that are bundled by scammers who, you know, are deliberately, you know, painting charts to make it look like it's up only, and then we'll instantly dump, you know, 60% of the supply that they control from 100 different wallets on top of all these, you know, unsuspecting normal people who've never used crypto before. You have big problems because that's going to leave a bad taste in people's mouth, and it's frankly.
Do you have data that because I would agree absolutely. With you if I thought normies were the ones on the buy side.
I do.
You have data that shows that? Because
I have,
buying meme coins is not easy. Like my mother wouldn't be able to buy a meme coin. Bridging across like three cryptocurrencies to buy Trump coin is not simple. So why do you think normies were the ones getting rug pulled?
So I have anecdotal experience of this. My friends have known I've been in crypto for a very long time. And I see, you know, when my friends reach out to me and say, you know, oh, you know, I need to get into crypto. It happened in 2021 with NFTs. It went silent for a while. And then around Trump launch,
okay,
I got a lot of texts. You need to teach me how to buy meme coins. And I will say it's gotten so, so, so much easier. There's an app, for example, it's called Moonshot. It was, you know, a top 10 downloaded app at one week in the last 2-3 months. You buy crypto with a credit card, 3 clicks, you can buy it. There's another one called Vector. Super popular. You know, Phantom, the wallet Phantom, the UI is so slick. They've done a fantastic job building a really easy to use wallet. And you can, you know, buy meme coins in. And I know plenty of people who do. And
I'm more libertarian than you on this issue, because I have zero sympathy for the folks who got plugged. To me, here's why. Maybe I'm making a mistake. It is so obviously a scam that it's like no different from like three card. It used to be a game called Three Card Monty. Mm-hmm. Three card. You know what Three Card
Monty? It still exists, by the way.
Like, right,
you can walk around the streets.
It was a known scam.
Yeah.
Like it was known, but it was fun. You'd stand around and like. So I view people who've lost money on meme coins. I don't view it as any different from them buying candy or like it is. I have zero sympathy for them, because it's not like when my mother, when I was in business school and it was the first crash, and these shady brokers were calling like widows at home and conning them into buying some shitty tech stock. There was none of that happening. To buy, you had to, as you said, you had to call someone you knew. So my position is everybody knew that they were buying a $1 in a billion lottery ticket. And I have no problem with them getting wiped out. But what, so why am I wrong on that?
So I actually agree, generally speaking, with that idea as a libertarian that, you know, like, listen, if you go to the casino and you go play roulette with your entire net worth, you're a fucking idiot, like 100%. You know, but we're in an age, right? Today is a time where social media is omnipresent and matters more than anything. And it's all flashy lifestyle, get rich quick, you know, sell a drop shipping course, e-commerce, you name it. That's all the rage. You know, people go on YouTube and there's people with billions of views selling $10,000 courses, all this stuff. And these people,
hustle culture, right?
Yeah. And they're selling a dream of get rich quick and showing you, you know, screenshots of the guy who hit the Powerball, who put $100 into Dog with Hat Coin and turned it into 10 million. You know, that's what they're selling. And I think that, you know, we're at a time in history, in this country's history, where for my generation, prospects are bleak. You know, home prices are now, you know, 8+ times the average annual salary. You know, home buying a home, being a homeowner is very much
less, you know, likely in your reach than it was in the prior generation.
Exactly. It's a far cry. You know, when I go and buy a sandwich in New York City, when I go outside my apartment and buy a sandwich, I'm spending $15 minimum. You know what I mean? Life is expensive, and it's created this kind of financial nihilism that I've seen a lot of people calling it, where, you know, they are, you know, listen, they don't have money. Everything is expensive. The life that they dream themselves living or want to be living seems very far out of reach. And they are, you know, trying to do whatever they can to get it back. And even at the expense of their current financial situation, they're like, you know, it can't get much worse.
Why not?
Let's do some gambling. This is the same reason, I think, why you see, you know, gambling, you know, DraftKings, FanDuel growing at crazy, crazy rates. You know, people have turned into a gambling culture to get rich quick, to make it, because, you know.
You're missing one piece to this. Look, there was a show on Netflix about shopping, and it's literally about how the internet has changed our shopping habits, and it's all about convenience. So I don't know, Andrew, if you might have had this life experience. I'm sure John has, where you're trying to buy something on the internet and your wallet's in another room and your credit card's not in front of you. And the effort of having to go to the next room to get your credit card is enough to, I'll just buy it another day. Yep. Now, the websites remember our credit cards. You don't remember your credit card? It's okay. We've got it all here. All your addresses you ever shipped to? We've got it all here. We make it so easy and convenient to buy. So when we're looking at the culture as it relates to cryptocurrency and all these other things, we are in a culture of convenience. We're in a fast food culture, in a get rich quick. And there are things that are in conflict with every thought process, whether it's libertarian, conservatism, paternalism. I get it. Anyway, it's been a pleasure having you. Pretty sure John and I are going to want to have you back, because we've already been on for over an hour today, and there's a lot of golden nuggets here.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to come back. Thank you guys for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. It was fun talking to you guys.
You're a smart young guy, as a father, you know, I it makes me sad. Some of the things you said make me sad. Like this notion of financial. I we got to do another talk, because I want to get more into financial nihilism, because it is real. And I think we as adults, you're an adult, but we as older adults, sometimes we think, okay, this get rich quick thing, oh, it's all because you're lazy and you're impatient. And I do think there's some of that, but there's this underlying pathos and loss of hope that is driving that as well. And that as a dad makes me really, really sad that my daughters would believe, just look at the world. Look, you're lucky enough to be born in this country, right? It could be way worse. So you're born, you hit the jackpot by being born here, and to still think, I have no hope. I could never amount to anything. As a father, that just breaks my heart.
John, this is the conversation I have with my daughter, Olivia, who's 25 going on 26. Yeah. All of the things that Andrew said, she's been saying to me for at least 2 years, that they are the first generation to be financially worse off than the prior generations. So we can come back to sit there and talk about the mid-20s thought process on their financial future, because I think that would be very telling. And you've been in a room with me where I've defended people in their 20s from people in their 60s that were commenting on how lazy as a group that they were. And that's so not true.
I agree.
It's so not true. It's just
our generation says that. We said that about millennials. Gen X said that.
We said it about us.
They're all lazy. It's insane. They created Facebook. I mean, so... This I think it's important to bring Andrew back on and maybe some of his friends. Great. I want to get into this because it breaks my heart. Like, it's so sad to me. Because again, I will say this, like, I'm not saying it's not true. The numbers. But it could be worse. You could be born. I mean, you could be in much worse situations. So we got to figure out a way to inspire hope again.
Absolutely. I agree. It definitely, you know, could be worse, but I think a lot of the people my age don't really have that glass half full mentality. It's much more, you know, I'm never going to have the quality of life of my parents. I'm never going to be able to own a home. I'm never going to be able to, you know, retire. You know, it's sad. It really is. And it's awful. And, you know, obviously these people, you know, I think a lot realize that, you know, they could have been born into, you know, abject poverty in many places around the world. But, you know, they, you know, still even here, you know, feel like there's this loss of the American dream, that the American dream isn't really attainable anymore, or much more difficult to attain. And there's a number of reasons, and we can get into that into another episode. But
save these pearls of wisdom that you have to share with the public. We're going to have you back. Andrew Hirsch, thank you for your time today. We really enjoyed it. Signing off until next week.
No cap.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Andrew.
See you guys.
Take care, Andrew.
Bye.